Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat. It's the bomb.
Welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat, the weekly international news magazine keeping you up to date on all things nuclear from a different perspective. My name is Libby Halevi. I am the producer and host, as well as a survivor of the nuclear accident at Three Mile Island from just 1 mile away. So I know what can happen when those nuclear so-called experts get it wrong. This week, we talk with epidemiologist Joseph Mangano of Radiation and Public Health Project about studies he did that led to the article he co-authored with Dr. Janet Sherman on the invisible epidemic of thyroid cancer. Learn how Mangano and Dr. Sherman examined data from our own government and official agencies to discover the stark reality of nuclear risks hidden in plain sight. We also have a new feature, an Activist Action Minute, notice of one nuclear problem that needs attention, along with what you, yes, you, can do about it. This week, Erica Gray on how to help stop the Great Lakes nuclear dump. Plus, our popular Numbnuts of the Week feature, Nuclear Reactor Duck and Cover Report, Activist Shoutouts, and more honest nuclear information than appeared during all the ads on Super Bowl Sunday. And just think, any one of those puppies could fund our entire movement for years. But we'll have all of the nuclear information coming up in just a few moments. Today is Tuesday, February 9, 2016, and here is the week's nuclear news from our perspective. Actually, we'll be including some of the news from last week that got bumped with the breaking story on the Westlake landfill. The Indian Point nuclear facility in New York, just 35 miles from downtown Manhattan, has reported alarming levels of radioactivity in three water monitoring wells. The radioactive water leaked into groundwater, and the radioactivity at one of the wells has increased an alarmingly nearly 65,000%. In the arcane measuring system the nuclear industry uses to confuse us all, just consider the proportions here. The well went from 12,300 picocuries of radiation per liter to over 8 million picocuries per liter. Now, to give that further substance, that is the equivalent of 296,000 becquerels, which is radioactive disintegrations per second. So if you think of them like the shooting off of a gun, that would be 296,000 radioactive shots to your cells per second should you have ingested any of this water. Any improperly repaired damage to your cells may lead to cancer or inheritable damage. Owner-operator Entergy, which has been claiming there's really nothing to worry about here, did manage to acknowledge that the leak was not, quote-unquote, in accordance with our standards. Talk about your euphemisms. New York Governor Andrew Cuomo lashed out. This is not the first such release of radioactive water at Indian Point, nor is it the first time that Indian Point has experienced significant failure in its operation and maintenance, going on to say, "This failure continues to demonstrate that Indian Point cannot continue to operate in a manner that is protective of public health and environment." And U.S. Senator Charles Schumer from New York is calling on the Nuclear Regulatory Commission to investigate the leak of radioactive material into the groundwater, which is kind of like asking a fox to assess the damage in the hen house. We continue with the nuclear reactor duck and cover report. On Monday, February 8th, the Brunswick nuclear facility in North Carolina experienced an alert. which sounds benign, but is actually two steps up on a four-step scale to kiss your ass goodbye. It experienced a fire and explosion that threw the plant into a manual scram, meaning a shutdown mode, which took it down almost 50%. What's truly alarming about this is that the licensee admitted that it had notified Department of Homeland Security, FEMA, the U.S. Department of Agriculture, Health and Human Services, the Department of Energy, the Environmental Protection Agency, the Food and Drug Administration, and a couple of acronyms I can't even find on Google. This was not an ordinary accident to have generated that much notification. Entergy's Pilgrim nuclear facility in Plymouth, Massachusetts, was shut down on Monday morning, February 8th, as a precautionary measure, is what they're calling it, while a snowstorm swept through the state. Pilgrim spokesmodel Patrick O'Brien said, "The weather might be an issue, with loss of power possible." Loss of power at a nuclear power station. On January 27th, at South Texas Nuclear Generating Station, there was a loss of feed water to a steam generator, which caused a hot shutdown. A Department of Energy review team identified some significant deficiencies, to quote them, in the management of safety systems at the Y-12 storage facility that houses the nation's largest stockpile of bomb-grade uranium at Oak Ridge, Tennessee. The safety systems would be critical if there were a fire and potential dispersion of nuclear materials. And let's face it, 4 years ago, an 83-year-old nun was able to break in to do a peace demonstration. So how safe is the place? The NRC is deploying a team of 25 inspectors to conduct a comprehensive inspection at Arkansas Nuclear One, the Entergy, you catch a theme here, Entergy Operations Facility in Russellville, Arkansas. It's one of two nuclear power plants in the country with the regulator's Column 4 status. Another of the NRC's cutesy little labels that is just one step away from Column 5, which is mandatory shutdown. The units being inspected are 42 and 38 years old. Remember, nukes were only built to last for 40 years and then be shut down. The Columbia Generating Station, the only commercial nuclear reactor in the state of Washington, has agreed to hire an independent investigator to look into whistleblower allegations that the plant has ignored operational and safety problems in order to keep the nuclear power plant online. That's fine, as long as the investigation is on CGS and not the whistleblower. Your tax dollars being wasted. Watts Bar, America's first new, put that in quotes, nuclear power plant to be built in the 21st century, based on technology that is more than 40 years old, could end up costing $200 million more than what was forecast last year. And last year, they were saying $4.5 billion. Since this boondoggle was begun in 1973, the Tennessee Valley Authority, which is in charge of it, has spent more than $12 billion to finish two reactors. And nuclear operator Exelon is throwing yet another tantrum and threatening to close the nuclear facilities in Illinois if it does not get financial help from the financially strapped state. At risk of closure are two of Exelon's six Illinois nukes, the Quad City Station in western Illinois, and the Clinton plant downstate, to which Nuclear Hot Seat says, shut them down. Shut them all down. And that's this week's Nuclear Reactor Duck! and cover report. Things are looking up for nuclear waste at the Hanford site, at least 70 feet above ground. That's because instead of digging another 70-foot deep cell, meaning hole in the ground, to hold more nuclear waste at the massive landfill in central Hanford, they plan to try piling it higher. I guess they looked at what was happening in Japan with the so-called decontamination waste and went, hey, if they can pile it up, so can we. It's not working in Japan, but hey, doesn't mean it's not a role model for them. Do we really want this radioactive waste stored above ground? I mean, really, what's the worst that could happen? In a true case of nuclear dyslexia, North Carolina's Secretary of Environmental Quality, Donald Vandervaart, has decided to back restrictions on solar farms and incentives for nuclear plants. North Carolina ranks fourth nationally in solar energy capacity, and the industry employs about 5,600 people in the state. However, as has already happened in New York and also Washington State, North Carolina wants to redefine the state's renewable energy standards to allow incentives for new nuclear facilities, which Vandervaart said are needed to back up less dependable sources such as solar. This is, of course, based on the nuclear industry's perpetrated lie that nuclear is, quote unquote, it gags me to say these words, clean, green, and renewable. It is none of the same unless you consider renewable the way that nuclear waste just keeps on repeating and duplicating and expanding itself. A big salute to the Westlake moms from Just Moms STL, who are in Washington, D.C. right now to lobby officials, both elected and appointed, to get some relief from the nuclear disaster at their doorstep. For those of you who haven't been following the story, 175,000 tons of nuclear waste left over from World War II and the Manhattan Project is illegally buried at the Westlake landfill in North St. Louis, where it has been poisoning the local environment for decades. There are elevated cancer levels, immune system disorders, reproductive disorders, and much more that have been going on with the citizens there. In addition, for the past 5 years, an underground fire at the adjacent Bridgeton landfill has been bearing down on this radioactive legacy. As of last October, first responders reported that they believed the fire to be within 3 football fields of the waste and 3 to 6 months away from intersecting with it. Fire plus nuclear waste equals not good news for St. Louis or anywhere else. These courageous Westlake moms, along with the dads and their child-free supporters, are pushing the government to change the agency responsible for the cleanup from the incredibly inept Environmental Protection Agency to the Army Corps of Engineers, which has a program called FUSRAP, designed to handle this exact kind of cleanup. A bill to do just that cleared the Senate last Tuesday, and that's why the moms are in D.C., to lobby the House of Representatives and create a really big stir about this. But as long as we're talking about the EPA...
Nuclear hot seat, nuclear hot seat, nuclear hot seat, none that's out of week.
While the moms of North St. Louis and their international supporters have been inundating the EPA with demands for a meeting with the top personnel, the head of the EPA, Gina Never Met a Nuke I Didn't Like and Cover For McCarthy, has been playing duck and cover from the moms. The demands for a meeting with McCarthy have been so intense that all available lines on the EPA switchboard have been filled up. There's no room left in the message queue. And yet, Gina, baby, you're still sticking your fingers in your ear and closing your eyes and going, la, 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 I can't hear you. But honey, that ain't gonna work anymore. We don't care what your mother issues are. These are some moms who demand to hear from you, to meet with you, and give you a piece of their mind. You have been ducking out on every legitimate complaint against nuclear, going all the way back to Katie the Goat, if not before. So, baby, time to put on your big girl panties and sit down at that table and face the truth about how incompetent, inept, if not evil, the actions of you and your agency have been. And that's why you, Gina, Never Met a Nuke I Didn't Like and Cover For McCarthy, are this week's
Nuclear Hot Seat, none that's out of week.
several stories over the past few weeks about uranium mining and its impact on Native Americans. One states that the Navajo water supply is poisoned worse than Flint, Michigan, but that, as Native activists put it, no one cares because they're Native American. The point is that since the 1950s, Navajo water has been poisoned by uranium mining to fuel the nuclear industry and the making of atomic bombs for the U.S. military. Representatives of indigenous organizations from the Southwest, Northern Great Plains, and its supporters have called for no nukes in a protest addressing radioactive pollution caused by the 15,000 abandoned uranium mines posing a toxic threat in the United States. The demonstration was held at the Environmental Protection Agency's headquarters to call for an immediate cleanup of these hazardous sites amid charges that the EPA has been negligent in addressing these toxic threats that severely threaten public health, lands, and waterway. And speaking of the land, we have a link to a story on uranium mining beginning near the Grand Canyon. It's written by Diné activist Clee Benally, and we will have the link up on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 242. Over to Japan, where there has been a massive fiery eruption of Mount Sakurajima, a volcano on the island of Kyushu, which is only 50 kilometers or 31 miles away from the Sendai nuclear power plant. It erupted on Friday, February 5th, with a blast that sent lava rolling down the slopes and rocks flying 2 kilometers from the mountain's top. In the wake of the Fukushima nuclear disaster, which started almost exactly 5 years ago, all nuclear reactors in Japan were shut down. However, as of last October 15, the Sendai reactor was restarted, despite the fact that there were rumblings and the expectation of an eruption at Mount Sakurajima. Here's an odd item brought to us by Iori Mochizuki, who runs the truly informative site Fukushima Diary. According to Japan's Nuclear Regulatory Authority, cesium-134 and 137 density in Tokyo tap water is 24% higher than the tap water in Fukushima. This from a report that was released on October 30th that covers the period from July to September in 2015. According to this report, cesium-134 was not detected in the water in Fukushima, and yet it is known that cesium-134 is a marker for the Fukushima accident. The Fukushima prefectural government had no explanation as to why cesium-134 was not detected in its own drinking water. And Japan's National Institute for Environmental Studies, or NIES, has reported that the population and varieties of sea invertebrates significantly decreased around the Fukushima nuclear disaster site. This is from a study that was taken from 2011 to 2013 with over 50 sampling points inside and outside a 20-kilometer radius of the site. And despite that report, and one that we carried on Nuclear Hot Seat 2 weeks ago, that came from TEPCO and admitted that more than 40% of all fish caught within 20 kilometers or 12.5 miles of Fukushima Daiichi were found to be contaminated with cesium, the fishermen in Fukushima Prefecture have said that they plan to scale down their self-imposed fishing ban in waters off the damaged nuclear power plant, due mainly to what they are calling a substantial decline in radioactive cesium levels, which makes absolutely no sense. Instead of a 20-kilometer ban, they want to be able to fish within 10 kilometers of the radioactive remains of the nuclear facility. And this item, which is both Japanese and American. A Freedom of Information Act request for Hillary Clinton to release her email from immediately after the Fukushima disaster has yielded this nugget, which was sent within 4 days of the nuclear disaster. Ms. Clinton wrote in an email, and here I quote, "Wear a mask and a hat if possible. take a shower immediately after you return home, and wash your clothes. Radioactive steam was released yesterday and continues today. It will likely be in the area now. I won't be going outdoors for a while. End quote. This from the woman who, as Secretary of State, less than 1 month later, in April of 2011, signed an unrestricted trade agreement with Japan to bring its food and its product and its goods into the United States without any kind of special inspection. Further into international waters we go, as the tiny Marshall Islands are seeking to persuade the United Nations highest court to take up a lawsuit against India, Pakistan, and Britain, which it accuses of failing to halt the nuclear arms race. Three hearings will be held between March 7 and March 16. A previous lawsuit by the Marshall Islands against the United States for testing 67 nuclear weapons above ground near their territory between 1946 and 58, and then utilizing the people from those islands in a human test called Project 4.1, was dismissed exactly 1 year ago, February 9, 2015. In India, the former chairman of that country's Atomic Energy Regulatory Board, A. Gopalakrishnan, has stated that the new nuclear reactor at Kudankulam was one of the most dangerous nuclear reactors in the country. He alleges that the components that went into the construction of the unit at Kudankulam were not checked properly for quality, and said, "No one knows which part of the Kudankulam nuclear power plant is going to break down and on which day." He spoke on the day when the first unit at Kudankulam resumed power generation after a few months because of breakdowns. India and France have delayed the nuclear deal with Areva for the construction of 6 new nuclear reactors in India. Among the complicating factors that delayed the deal was the difficulty of negotiating India's laws on accident liability, which were rewritten after the Bhopal gas tragedy of 1984, where a leak of toxic gas from a Union Carbide facility led to at least 16,000 deaths. And in Canada, Bruce Power, the nuclear facility on the shores of Lake Huron that is intent on building a nuclear waste repository only a mile away from the shores of that great lake, has had its operating license extended to cover the operation of the facility until 2064. No wonder they want that repository, but they may not last that long. Reactor A at Bruce went online in 1977, and Unit B went online in 1984, which, if they should survive and keep operating to the end of their current license, would have them being 87 and 80 years old, respectively. And who knows, the license could be extended beyond that. We'll have this week's featured interview in just a moment, but first, I'm really looking forward to going to St. Louis for the February 20th symposium on the Westlake Landfill, Bridgeton Landfill Fire, Coldwater Creek Radiation Contamination, and all the rest of the mess that's the legacy of World War II era Manhattan Project nuclear waste. To cover all the action, which will include interviews with Dr. Helen Caldicott, Bob Alvarez, and the real housewives, the real brave housewives of North St. Louis, a.k.a. the Westlake Moms, I still need your help to cover the trip's expenses. As you know, Nuclear Hot Seat operates on donations from you, the listeners, and now would be a great time to show your support. Give what you can. I consider all donations symbolic of the esteem and the respect in which you hold Nuclear Hot Seat. So give what you can. Many listeners donate the equivalent of a cup of Starbucks a month, and it's the best cup of coffee I will never drink. Donating is easy. Just go to the website, nuclearhotseat.com, and click on the big red donate button. Whatever you can do to help get me to St. Louis so I can get the stories and bring them back alive, you have my gratitude. Joseph Mangano is an epidemiologist and executive director of the Radiation and Public Health Project Research Group, an organization so long established it has a web address that consists of a single word, radiation.org. It was a long time ago for them to be able to get that. Joe is our own Sherlock Holmes when it comes to examining health statistics to tease out the nuclear messages hidden within. He's great at it. Joseph and Dr. Janet Sherman recently published an article, An Invisible Epidemic, about thyroid cancer rates in proximity to nuclear reactors, including Fukushima Daiichi and your own neighborhood nuke just down the block. Here's our talk. Joseph Mangano, thank you so much. It's always a joy to have you as a guest on Nuclear Hot Seat.
Thank you for having me.
First of all, I don't think we've ever done this. Explain what an epidemiologist is and what such a person does.
Epidemiologist is a fancy word for a statistician who does work in the health field, health statistics. It's basically the study of patterns of disease, patterns of death, and patterns of other health trends.
You work with Dr. Janet Sherman, and the two of you focus your studies, at least the ones that I've seen, on nuclear radiation-related issues. Why did you choose this area of study?
Let me define what we study, because this is really what the whole group does, the Radiation and Public Health Project. Radiation can mean several things. It can mean natural radiation in the rocks in the air. It can mean medical radiation, such as x-rays and scans. Or it can mean a certain type of radiation called ionizing radiation. And that means two discrete things. One, atomic bombs, and two, the chemicals that are used in nuclear power reactors to make electricity. Our focus has been on the nuclear reactors. There are 99 in this country. There are about just under 400 around the world that make electricity by taking a uranium atom and splitting it exactly the way it's done to explode an atomic bomb.
You recently published an article, An Invisible Epidemic, Can an Epidemic Really Sneak Up on Us Like This, about thyroid cancer. What led you to write this particular article at this time?
Well, what I just described in my last answer was nuclear reactors produce electricity. There's one problem with reactors, and that is the chemicals that are produced in reactors to make this electricity are dangerous. They are radioactive chemicals. Chemicals we don't find in nature. Chemicals we first observed or first were created in the 1940s during World War II in the race to make the atomic bomb. Different chemicals such as iodine-131, strontium-90, cesium-137. Each of them, as I said, is radioactive. Each of them, if it enters a human body or an animal or plant, is harmful. It gets into the body. The body is damaged. The cells are damaged. And it can lead to various diseases such as cancer. That's how I got to thyroid cancer. And there are hundreds of these, by the way, between 100 and 200 separate chemicals. I named three of them, but there are many, many more. Each of them goes to a different part of the body. Thyroid cancer, which our most recent article was about, is the home of radioactive iodine chemicals. The thyroid gland uses iodine, non-radioactive iodine, as a part of functioning normally. However, radioactive iodine is not normal. And when it is released from a nuclear power plant or from an atomic bomb explosion, it's taken into the body. It immediately goes from the stomach to the bloodstream and right to the thyroid gland, which is a little gland. It looks like a butterfly. It's wrapped around the throat. And unlike natural radiation, the radioactive iodine attacks cells. It kills them, it impairs them, and leads to disease.
What are the current
thyroid cancer rates, and why the need for alarm? Why do you call this an epidemic?
Radiation, as I said, is hundreds of chemicals that are out there. They're being released. They go into the body. Radioactive iodine in thyroid cancer is kind of special for a couple of reasons. First of all, we know that the thyroid gland is very sensitive to iodine, and especially in the very young, during pregnancy and infancy and childhood. We also know that if you ask any doctor what causes thyroid cancer, the list is extremely short. The Mayo Clinic only has three causes. One is being a female. Females get it more, which is really not a cause. And number two is having certain genetic patterns. Well, that's not a cause either. There's something that caused these odd genetic patterns. The third and final cause, the Mayo Clinic says, is exposure to ionizing radiation. So we know there's a direct contact. And in the last 70 years of the atomic era, thyroid cancer has probably been the most studied, along with childhood cancer, has been the most studied of any type of disease compared to the radiation it takes in. And as far as rates go, in the early 1990s, every year in the United States, about 12,000 new cases were diagnosed. Now, the number is 62,000. All right, it's gone up more than five times, and every year it's going up and up and up. Males and females, whites and blacks and Hispanics, people in cities, in rural areas, it is just all over our society, and no one has really quite put their finger on why. And that's what we're trying to do.
How likely is it that the improvements in the detection of thyroid cancer, better equipment and better detection systems available, are, as some are claiming,
are the reason why we're catching
more cases at an earlier time?
That's a very good question, and the answer is sure. Better detection systems are probably a reason for this higher number. However, it's probably a small reason, and I'll tell you why. There's two ways to detect thyroid cancer. There is no screening program like mammography for breast cancer or colonoscopy for colon cancer. There's no screening program for thyroid cancer. It's detected in two ways. Number one, on a routine visit to a doctor, and he palpates or touches the throat area and feels a lump. And number two, in the cases of more advanced thyroid cancers, symptoms. You know, there's some sort of pain or discomfort that the patient reports to the doctor. There's really no evidence that compared to the 1990s, doctors are doing a better job in palpating. It's something they've been doing for decades. There's no real evidence that patients are more wise to reporting any sort of pain or discomfort. It's been going on for years. So, again, there's probably some part of the increase is due to better detection, but it's probably quite small. The rest of it is a big question mark, and this is what we're trying to get at, because thyroid cancer is fast becoming one of the most common cancers in our society. It's the seventh most common now. It was 20th years ago, and now it's moving up rapidly.
What are the possible causes of this thyroid cancer spike?
Our focus was strictly on the radiation theory as a cause. And yes, there may be some portion of it, of the thyroid cancer rise, due to a sort of delayed response to the atomic bomb tests of the 1950s and 60s, which were done above the ground and sent fallout across the country, and which came back into the environment through rain and snow and were taken in food and water. There may be some of that, but these haven't been done since the 1960s. Probably the more likely answer are the 99 reactors in this country that are generating electricity, nuclear power reactors. As I said, there's 99 of them. The highest we've ever had was 112. They're also getting very old and very corroded, and they're leaking more, you see, as they get older. They're not really building any reactors for quite some time now. So our feeling was that this is the main reason. And plus, it's not just a feeling. In 2009, I published a medical journal article which showed the highest rates in the country of thyroid cancer are in a 90-mile radius, a circle encompassing eastern Pennsylvania, southern New York, central New Jersey. In that 90-mile ball are 16 reactors. 13 of them are still operating. It is the most dense concentration of reactors in this country. And one of them happens to be Three Mile Island, which, of course, suffered a partial meltdown in 1979. So that is another piece of evidence that says releases are causing this thyroid cancer increase.
Is there any correlation between a closer proximity? You're talking about a 90-mile radius. But is there any study or any evidence that the closer you get to the reactor, the higher the risk that one faces of developing thyroid cancer?
Yes. Our organization, about a decade ago, did the only study ever that looked at radiation levels in bodies of Americans living near nuclear reactors. We called it the Tooth Fairy Project, which sounds like a little game, but it was a serious scientific study looking at the levels of another radioactive chemical, strontium-90, in baby teeth. It wasn't our idea. Several studies had been done starting in the 1950s, and we found that near six nuclear plants, the levels of strontium-90 were quite a bit higher in the counties where the reactors were located, about 40%, 50% higher than further areas. So we know that the closer you are to a reactor, the more it gets into your body.
What correlation, if any, is there to Fukushima and the ongoing radiation release that is happening there?
There's a lot of correlation. Even though when I'm talking about reactors releasing radioactivity, it's more of an ongoing thing. We call them routine releases. A reactor can't run without routinely releasing a portion of the radioactivity it produces. Okay, then in the case of Fukushima 5 years ago, and also in history, as I mentioned, Three Mile Island in the 70s and Chernobyl in the 1980s, very, very large amounts of radiation are released. Fukushima, the experts are still discussing it, but it is either the first or second worst meltdown in nuclear history. And unfortunately, it's still not controlled. The releases are still going on. They're still getting into the air and into the Pacific Ocean, and they're still heading to the United States. Interestingly, the Fukushima Medical University is studying children who live near Fukushima, about 300,000 of them, and they have found in 4 years that there have been 127 new cases of thyroid cancer, which doesn't sound like much, but in a normal population like that, there should be about 8. So we're talking about, 30 times, 40 times more than expected, which, again, backs up our theory that the more iodine, the more radiation you're exposed to, the higher your risk of diseases like thyroid cancer.
Make a distinction, if you would, between the dangers of external radiation, which I think is what most people think about, just the rays coming at you, the nuclear particles coming at you, and internal exposure when you have either eaten or drunk something that has radiation in it.
First of all radiation has a risk, even if it's used for a good purpose. You know, a doctor gives you an x-ray to diagnose a disease you might have, or gives you a CAT scan, or sometimes radiation therapy to treat a disease. Yes, these are helpful uses of the atom, but of course, any physician, any scientist will tell you that there is a risk involved. Now, with external radiation, as you mentioned, which occurs like in scans and x-rays, it's a beam, it's a ray, and it goes zipping right through your body. Zoom. In fact, nothing can stop an x-ray except for lead. However, it doesn't stick around very long. Within milliseconds, it zips right through. Now, with these chemicals created by atomic bombs or nuclear reactors, that's different. They get into the air, and they are taken into the body either by breathing or food or water. And then they go to the whatever organ that they are attracted to. Iodine heads for the thyroid gland. Strontium heads for bone and for teeth. Cesium disperses throughout all the soft tissues. Okay, these are specific poisons that do specific jobs on the human body. And in the case of like a strontium-90, which has been discussed for back to the 50s and 60s in the debate whether to keep bomb testing or not, It gets into the bone and the bone marrow. And in the bone marrow are the red and the white blood cells, which is the immune army. All right. Any chance a human has of fighting off a disease depends on your red and white blood cells. And strontium attacks these white blood cells. Okay, that became a real rallying cry, which led President Kennedy to cease all above bomb tests.
Where do you pull your statistics from that you base your studies on?
Yeah, the statistic on thyroid cancer are all official statistics reported by health departments and eventually to the National Cancer Institute.
So what response have you gotten to these studies, to this article, say, either in the government or in any official body that is dealing with the cancer epidemic?
Typically, to this article and to other articles we've written, we have done 34 articles in scientific journals. Typically, there is either no response from government and industry or a denial. No, it can't be releases from reactors. The levels are just too low to cause harm. Well, that's like saying if you smoke 3 cigarettes a day, it's okay. That's a low level. It can't be harmful. Well, it's not as much as 3 packs a day, but it is going to cause some sort of harm. And the government has really been rather silent, and industry have been rather silent on this thyroid epidemic.
What do you say to those individuals who try and make us believe that your methodology is flawed in getting the results that you do get?
Yes, very often there are critiques from industry and from government. Of course, the issue there is, where are their studies proving that nuclear reactors are safe? The answer is there are none. Okay, they just make a statement, they say, below a certain level, it's safe. Okay, we're going to measure how much you release. Oh, it's below a certain level, it's safe. That's not very good science. That's very poor science, actually. As far as studies that are out there that in medical journals that are proving this safety, they simply don't exist. In 60 years of running nuclear reactors, there has only been one government study of cancer near nuclear reactors. And the only reason that was done in the late 80s was because Senator Ted Kennedy forced them to do it. And since then, there have been none. They tried to get another one going a few years ago, and this year the Nuclear Regulatory Commission canceled the study. I think that's really not doing a disservice to the American people, who have a right to know if the air they're breathing and the food they're eating and the water they're drinking is harming them or not.
Knowing what you do about the impact of radiation on the thyroid and certainly on our total physical health, what, if anything, do you advise people do to protect themselves?
As a group, our work is to simply do the studies and to try to document the possible risks of radiation. As far as what people can do for themselves, we've really not taken an official stance on it. But I can tell you this, that if people become involved in helping to shut down nuclear reactors so that we can get our electricity from much safer sources, totally safe sources such as solar and wind, that would be helpful. This, in fact, happened over 50 years ago with the atomic bomb above ground tests. Many people were very upset that this fallout was going all over the place and all over the country and getting into our food. There were mass demonstrations in front of the White House, in front of the United Nations, demanding that President Kennedy sign this treaty, and in fact he did. And right after that treaty, the infant deaths went sharply down. Childhood cancer went sharply down. That treaty, which was not just the U.S., but the Soviet Union in England, probably saved millions of lives. It's the Limited Test Ban Treaty of 1963. If people get involved and demand that their leaders either prove safety or develop safer ways to make electricity, we can certainly change. And we know, too, that in studies we've done, when you close nuclear reactors immediately in the local county or two, there's an immediate drop in infant deaths, an immediate drop in child cancer, and over a long term, a drop in all cancers. So, again, this is a life-saving issue.
What's next for you and Dr. Sherman and Radiation and Public Health Project, RPHP?
You know, when we started the group back in 1989, there wasn't a whole lot of research done. Our total focus at the time was to get out studies, get out information on disease rates to nuclear plants, on how much radiation was getting in the body, such as the baby tooth study. As time has gone on and we have published these 34 articles and others have published the same, of course we're going to keep publishing new studies. But in addition, we're going to be doing just what I was discussing with you during the last question, putting this information out for the public to understand so that they can demand of their leaders that they be told the full truth about nuclear reactors and their hazards, and that they be better protected.
If a community or even an individual wanted to fund you and RPHP to create an epidemiological study on their area, how would they proceed to do that?
We have a website, www.radiation.org. We ask that you take a look at it, and it's full of information, our studies, some of the press conferences we've done, and there's also a way to make a donation using PayPal, very easy to do. We appreciate all support. We get no money from government. We get no money from industry. It's simply foundations who are interested in this or individuals.
And if an individual or a foundation or a community or a local government would want to have a study, is that something that they could engage with you to create?
Yeah, we've done that quite frequently. We've done many, many studies for communities who are interested in knowing what's out there. No, the information is out there. You know, the statistics are in the computer. The National Cancer Institute collects it, but no one has analyzed it. No one has looked at, you know, the rates after a nuclear plant opens or closes or as it gets older, and they come to us, and we have done a number of those. Many of those are on our website as well.
Joe, as always, you have been a wealth of information, and you represent one of the pieces of bedrock upon which we, the activists, can base our claims and our actions. And I want to thank you for the work that you do, and also for being my guest this week on Nuclear Hot Seat.
Thank you for having me.
That was epidemiologist Joseph Mangano, Executive Director of the Radiation and Public Health Project Research Group. Their website is radiation.org. We'll also have a direct link to the article on thyroid cancer rates up on the website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 242. Activist shout-outs. The chief engineer of Fairwinds Energy Education, Arne Gunderson, is returning to Japan. It's a speaking tour to again promote the book he published in 2012, Fukushima Daiichi, Truth and the Way Forward, which he wrote with co-authors Fairwinds President Maggie Gunderson and international barrister Ruiko Okazaki. Arne and Ruiko will be presenting talks on the subject of malfunctioning atomic reactors and faulty design during worst-case disaster scenarios. Arne will also discuss the malfeasance of both U.S. and Japanese atomic regulators in regards to how the nuclear industry has been allowed to cut corners during the construction of atomic power plants. Other devoted truth seekers presenting during this tour will be Mary Olson, radioactive waste policy specialist from Nuclear Information and Resource Service, or NIRS, and Stephen Leeper, a professor of peace studies at Hiroshima Jogakuin University, and a former leader of the Hiroshima Peace Culture Foundation. Safe journey to you all. Congratulations to Christian Brune and the team that produced the documentary, The Man Who Saved the World. It just won Best Documentary at the Danish Film Academy Awards. Too bad it's not nominated for the Oscars. You can hear all about this extraordinary film on Nuclear Hot Seat number 223 from September 29th, 2015. One of my favorite news sources online has been Erica Gray, who posts every week the NRC's unusual events and alerts.
Erica has my deepest admiration because she actually listens to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission's departmental phone calls that are open to the public, but the public usually can't bear because they're so dry, boring, and filled with acronyms. And they go on and on for 5 hours or more. Erica, you're a better woman than I. Here's what Erica has to say in what we hope will become a regular feature, an Activist Action Minute.
Hi, this is Erica Gray. Did you know that a nuclear power station in Canada wants to build its nuclear waste dump less than a mile from the shores of Lake Huron? A decision might be made March 1st. This issue is extremely important. The Great Lakes supplies 40 million people with their drinking water. It's 21% of the world's fresh surface water, and placing a nuclear waste dump less than a mile from the Great Lakes puts everybody at risk. So this is what you can do to help. Go to the website, www.stopthegreatlakesnuclearedump.com. You can sign the petition online. You can also find more information about the issue. Write to your representatives and the Prime Minister, Mr. Trudeau of Canada.
That was Erica Gray. I suggest that you take her advice and just check out StopTheGreatLakesNuclearDump.com. There's a great video up on the site that will explain everything you need to know in 3 minutes, and we'll also have a link up to that video. If I can figure out how to get the video up on the site, I'll do that as well. It will be at NuclearHotSeat.com under this episode, number 242. Here's today's final thought. I've been wondering for a long time now how the nuclear industry as a whole can be so dim-witted or short-sighted or numb-nutsed up or any phrase you can think of as to put all of our futures at risk for the artificial, though currently very powerful, concept of money. Yes, greed is a mental illness worthy of its own 12-step program, Greed Anonymous. But that doesn't explain how thoroughly embedded this institutionalized carelessness has become throughout every aspect of the industry. Recently, I've come up with a phrase that, for me, at least for now, encapsulates what we are up against. Just three little words. Systemic, psychotic, incompetence. Systemic, because the whole system surrounding nuclear energy and nuclear weapons is poisoned against the common sense that would demand extreme care and caution, if not immediate shutdown. Psychotic, because the definition of psychotic is a severe mental disorder in which thought and emotions are so impaired that contact is lost with external reality. I think that describes the nuclear industry quite well. Finally, incompetence. Do we even have to discuss the incompetence of the nuclear industry? It takes up the majority of Nuclear Hot Seat every week, and there have been plenty of examples in this episode alone. So the nuclear industry is comprised of a collection of mentally ill, incompetent greed mongers working together without conscience or empathy in charge of the most dangerous, deadly technology ever invented by the human race with the potential to poison us out of existence. Systemic, psychotic incompetence. First one of you to come up with a rap song that incorporates that phrase gets it played on the show. This has been Nuclear Hot Seat for Tuesday, February 9th, 2016. Material for this week's program has been researched and compiled from
ENENews.com, PeekskillDailyVoice.com, NewYorkDailyNews.com, Potsmerk.com, WNCN, Times Free Press, ChicagoBusiness.com, NuclearStreet.com, KnoxNews.com, Informable.com, OregonLive.com, Tri-CitiesHerald.com, Blog.LiveDoor.jp, CountercurrentsNews.com, EurasiaReview.com, IndigenousActions.org, Radchik Radiation Research Mitigation, EuropeanNewsWeekly.wordpress.com and its intrepid captain, Sean Arklight, NukeProfessional.blogspot.ca, JapanTimes.co.jp, Fukushima-diary.com, and our friend Iori Mochizuki, NIES.go.jp, ChinaPost.com, TheHindu.com, TheGuardian.com, TransCanada.com, CTVNews.ca, Nuclear-News.net, PennEnergy.com, ABC.NET.AU, World Nuclear Association, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, and the Nuclear Hot Seat community on Facebook, Heroes All, which you are invited to visit and like and follow. Theme music written by me, sung by Marilee Weber, accompanied by John Barnard, and recorded at Winslow Court Studio in Hollywood. Nuclear Hot Seat is syndicated by UCY.TV on StuWebRadioNetwork.com, formerly Veterans Truth Network, in New Zealand by NewZSentinel.com, and on ActivateMedia.org. We are always looking for other networks to connect with, so if you know a news aggregator or a community radio station that would like to carry the show, do put us in touch. And if you know anybody at Sirius XM, a satellite time slot would be just wonderful. Be certain to check out our archive, especially if you're new to the show and want to catch up. You can find us on iTunes under podcast. The archive is also available on the website, nuclearhotseat.com, and on our YouTube channel under Nuclear Hot Seat Videos. A reminder that your contribution helps keep Nuclear Hot Seat going and growing. And right now, getting me to St. Louis to cover the Westlake landfill disaster. So please do what you can this week to help us out with a donation at nuclearhotseat.com. Nuclear Hot Seat is the activist voice on nuclear issues. So if you have a story lead, a hot tip, or a suggestion of someone to interview, send an email to info@nuclearhotseat.com. We are copyright 2016, Libby Halevi and Hardestry Communications. All rights reserved, but fair use allowed as long as proper attribution is provided. Going out on an oldie but goodie today, Tom Lehrer's Pollution. In honor of all of you at Westlake, Flint, and Porter Ranch. This is Libby Halevi of Hardestry Communications, the heart of the art of communicating, reminding you that we have all had our nuclear wake-up call. Now, don't go back to sleep, because we are all in the nuclear hot seat.
Time was when an American about to go abroad would be warned by his friends or the guidebooks not to drink the water. But times have changed, and now a foreigner coming to this country might be offered the following advice.
If you visit American City, you will find it very pretty. Just two things of which you must beware. Don't drink the water and don't breathe the air. Pollution, pollution, they got smog and sewage and mud. Turn on your tap and get hot and cold running crud. See the halibuts and the sturgeons being wiped out by detergents. Fish gotta swim and birds gotta fly, but they don't last long if they try. Pollution, pollution, you can use the latest toothpaste and then rinse your mouth with industrial waste. Just go out for a breath of air, and you'll be ready for Medicare. The city streets are really quite a thrill. If the hoods don't get you, the monoxide will. Pollution, pollution, wear a gas mask and a veil. Then you can breathe, long as you don't inhale. Lots of of things there that you can drink. But stay away from the kitchen sink, the breakfast garbage that you throw into the bay. They drink at lunch in San Jose. So go to the city, see the crazy people there, like lambs to the slaughter. They are drinking the water and breathing the air.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are leaving.